Welcome to the Baptist Joint Committee podcast. I'm Jordan Edwards, Communications Associate at the BJC. Today we're going to discuss the oral arguments in the case Zubik v. Burwell, the name given to the consolidated cases challenging the contraceptive mandate of the Affordable Care Act. With me, I have two members of the BJC staff who were in the courtroom for oral arguments on March 23rd. Brent Walker, Executive Director of the BJC. Brent, how are you?
I'm great, Jordan. How are you?
Good, good. And Jennifer Hawks, Associate General Counsel of the BJC. Jennifer, how are you?
I'm good, Jordan. It's good to be here.
So first, Jennifer, could you please explain the case briefly and the BJC's amicus brief that we filed?
The case has a lot of complexities and a lot of different angles to it, but essentially there are about three dozen religious nonprofits and individuals who were challenging the accommodation that the government created for them in the contraceptive mandate for the Affordable Care Act, and they are consolidated under the name of Zubik v. Burwell. We did file a brief in the case. Our brief was written by Professor Douglas Laycock of the University of Virginia, who is a leading religious liberty advocate and scholar. And our brief makes two points. The first point is that complying with the accommodation of the Affordable Care Act is not a substantial burden. And the second point is that just because the government created a different exemption for churches and houses of worship does not mean that that exemption has to be carried over to all religious objectors.
So now, Brent, I'll turn to you. What were some of your impressions of the oral arguments and what happened in the courtroom that day?
As you know, Jordan, with the unfortunate death of Justice Scalia, the court only has eight members now until a successor is nominated and confirmed. I guess one of the most obvious things in the courtroom was that the four justices that are sometimes called the liberal justices were on one side, and the other four, the so-called conservative justices, seemed to be on the other side, at least in terms of how they interacted with counsel and asked questions. The divide was pretty clear as we sat through an hour and a half of arguments. Usually it's just 1 hour for a case, but the court granted an hour and a half for this one. But, you just don't know how it's going to come out. Conventional wisdom, if you ask the lawyers that left the court that day, they would say, well, it looks like it's 4-4, and 4-4 is going to maintain the status quo from the lower court decision. But, you know, Justice Kennedy is sometimes hard to predict. He asks some pretty tough questions on both sides. If he were to go with the faction that seemed to uphold the government side, it could be 5-3. So we don't know how that's going to come out until the decision comes down.
Now, Jennifer, what was your legal analysis of this? I know you took very thorough notes and have looked over the arguments, the transcript of it. So what was your reaction to what happened?
It was fairly predictable with the line of the questioning of most of the justices. There were fair and hard questions asked of both sides and some pretty good responses. Sometimes the attorneys responding to the question were so anticipating a harsh or negative question that they may have over-responded instead of it being a softball question that they should have been able to hit out of the park.
You know, sometimes you can get the feeling that the justices are playing devil's advocate one side or the other, particularly Kennedy, maybe more than some of the others. But I really felt like the court was taking sides. It was, asking softball questions for the side that they tended to favor and more difficult questions for the other side. It was just wonderful that Justice Ginsburg mentioned the Baptist Joint Committee's brief specifically, the fact that we had led the charge for the Religious Freedom Restoration Act back in 1993, the act that formed the basis of this claim. And there were two or three other times that more obliquely the BJC's brief was referred to by the lawyers and also from Justice Kagan, I think it was.
Now, you've been around a long time, you've been to the BJC 27 years, but does it ever get old hearing the BJC's name referenced by a judge or the brief referenced by a justice?
No, absolutely not. Never gets old. We relish that happening. Even if they don't acknowledge it, you can see evidence of your brief in the opinions that are written. That's a real high as well to be able to know that you're influencing not just what the justices say in open court, but what they've written that'll be around for the next 1,000 years.
Let's listen to a clip of Justice Ginsburg referencing the BJC's brief. The first voice you'll hear is of one of the petitioner's counsel, Paul Clement.
If my clients filed the form, they get the same tax-exempt status as the churches. The only difference in that provision is whether you filed the form. The substantive treatment is exactly the same. To use that line to draw a distinction between churches and universities or the Little Sisters of the Poor is a terrible line to draw. And if
what
you go back
to the line drawing problem, and that is a brief that's been mentioned several times, the Baptist Joint Committee, by a leading proponent of RFRA, discusses this line drawing problem. Did you just say that's wrong?
It's likely that this will be a 4-4 decision, and both sides don't seem to mind that it might be a 4-4 decision. So what is your opinion of a 4-4 decision if this happens? Is this good for the side of the government the BJC took, or is that bad?
Well, in these seven cases, since we did file on the side of the government won at the lower court level in all seven cases. And so, therefore, by default, the government would win because there would not be 5 votes to overturn the lower court's opinion. The problem is the Eighth Circuit went the other direction. And so you would have a handful of states that are governed by a different set of rules as opposed to the eight circuits that have ruled in favor of the government.
Brent, have you ever seen anything like this in terms of A, the polarization of the court, and B, having an empty seat like this?
Well, I mean, the court, I think, has been polarized for the past couple of decades and becoming increasingly so. But no, this is the first time I've ever seen the 4-4 standoff with an unexpected death of one of the justices.
Yeah.
It's just unprecedented in my memory.
Now, you spoke to the media following oral arguments, which you've done many times before, but this is most likely your last time as executive director to do so. Did you feel any sort of that this was a special moment being your last time as executive director, or was it just kind of business as usual?
It didn't occur to me that might be my last time. You're probably right, although we have another case coming, but it won't be argued until next fall, right?
Correct.
Yeah. As executive director, this is probably your last.
Sure. Yeah, sure. It may be my last one. Well, shoot, I wish I'd thought about that. But you know, I've done it before, but it's still a special moment to be out front with all of the microphones there and all the press, and you know, to be able to speak for 2 or 3 minutes for the media. We don't actually argue cases inside the courtroom other than what we say in our brief, but we do get to say a few words outside, and that's something that we really hold on to and try to do each and every case that we file in.
So we've talked specifically about the arguments themselves and about the case itself, but for those listening, this is a unique environment to be inside the court during arguments for such an important case. So Brent, can you give us a sense of the environment inside the courtroom and what it's like to go through and be present for this sort of thing?
The environment is all over the place. It's outside and inside the Supreme Court building, if not inside the courtroom itself. Jennifer and I, as members of the Supreme Court Bar, get to go in and observe the arguments, but you have to line up beforehand inside the court in the sort of the basement level. And we got there,
maybe 8 o'clock, two hours
before the court started.
And is that typical or atypical how early you have to be there?
No, usually you don't have to be there quite that early, but we knew there would be a big turnout. So we got there 2 hours ahead of time, and we were, 68, 69, 70 in line, something like that. And then Jennifer was in front of me, and she got the last ticket.
I did.
So I would not have been completely excluded because I would have gone into the lawyer's lounge to listen to the case. But the clerk was nice enough to find me another ticket besides the ones that they had on hand. And so I did get to go into the courtroom. So even the lawyers have to line up like the public does outside. The public, there were people lined up several days I think, before to get in. But so we were able to get in. While we were in line, and this was just an amazing thing to me. A member of Congress comes up.
An unnamed member of
Congress. No, I'm not going to give the name or the party. I will say he, so it wasn't a she. It was a he who was so rude. Walked up to the front of the line and laid down his card, identification card from Congress, and say, "I'm so-and-so member of Congress, and I want a seat." And I said, sorry, sir, we're out of seats. Well, I'm a member of Congress, and I demand the courtesy of a seat to watch this very important argument. And if I can't get a seat, I'm going to go back across the street and file a bill to compel you to provide an ongoing space for members of Congress. A little problem about the separation of powers. I don't think that's going to work too well. But and then when we got upstairs to go through the magnetometer, he does the same thing. He gets up, puts down his card, and purports to walk around straight into the courtroom without going to the magnetometer. And they stopped him and made him go, and he blew up over that and again made his threat to go file a bill and make the Supreme Court pay him more respect. But, I just thought that was so unseemly and out of line. And actually, I told him so. So I hope I didn't.
What did you tell him?
Well, I just said, Congressman, that you're just way out of line. You have no right to treat these people that way. They're just following their orders and doing their job. I'm just disappointed that you're acting this way. And he was taken aback. He didn't respond, but I think he was smarting that I called him on it. But anyway, all kinds of stuff goes on in that court, in the courtroom, the courthouse, and outside. Demonstrators pro and con, and debate back and forth. Just a real amazing event in the life of our democracy to take in the entire spectacle of an oral argument in the Supreme Court on a very important case such as this one.
You know, when you tell that story, it reminds me of something that your predecessor, the late great James Dunn, would have done in terms of responding to the congressperson and calling them out on acting that way.
Well, not only that, but he would have told his name in this podcast too.
yeah. He would have had some choice language. Besides watching the oral arguments and standing in line and the spectacle of seeing everyone dressed up and everything, when you come down to speak in front of the microphones to the media, how does that work in terms of who gets to speak first, who gets to speak at all? How do you decide that?
You just kind of get up there and elbow your way through and get there as best you can. So I guess I spoke fourth or fifth, and maybe there were 10 all told. Nina Totenberg from NPR asked me a question, and I responded to it. You don't always get questions. Sometimes you do, but Nina is sort of mama bear. She gets up there and gets her questions in for her coverage for the evening drive time report. And so she used my response to her question. You know, we got some TV coverage, certainly C-SPAN. I got on the local NBC news feed that goes out around the country.
What advice would you have to the next executive director in terms of navigating a Supreme Court oral argument day?
Listen to Holly Holman and Jennifer Hawks.
Yeah.
And do what they say.
Good answer. Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Jennifer, and thank you, Brent, for joining me. This has been the Baptist Joint Committee podcast. For more podcasts, subscribe to our iTunes channel or visit our podcast page at bjconline.org/podcasts. You can also learn more about the Zubik v. Burwell case at bjconline.org/Zubik.